Okay, it's time to start. I have a few little funny things to share with you this morning. This is from a book called Dear Pastor. Okay? Dear Pastor, I know God loves everybody, but he never met my sister. Yours sincerely, Arnold, age 8. Dear Pastor, are there any devils on earth? I think there may be one in my class. Carla, age 8. Dear Pastor, my father likes to sit in the last row at church so he can sneak out during the sermon. Sometimes my mom stops him before he sneaks out, but not last Sunday. Denise, age 11. Dear Pastor, we have 3 Bibles in our house. My mother reads the Bible every day, but my father reads the sports page. Okay, so today we're going to finish up the videos, and then I'm going to ask you questions from those chapters and also review. You know what I mean by review for the exam, right? Yeah, I'm just too easy. But so then you can record those things. And on Monday we'll take the final. Okay?
Are you still recording and putting them on the student portal too?
No.
Okay.
Nope, they will not be online, so so don't miss. Okay? All right, let's have, yes.
Nothing. We may be taking the Genesis final on Wednesday. Okay.
All right, so this is on chapter 22. Which is on the wisdom literature.
Well, you have persevered to the end. This is the final chapter, the Old Testament wisdom books. The Old Testament wisdom books include Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Songs. This is a very interesting collection of books, and the texts within them are fascinating. Some of them are fairly easy to understand. For example, look some of the Proverbs. Look at Proverbs 11:13. Gossip betrays a confidence, but a trustworthy person keeps a secret. Or how about Proverbs 10:12? Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers over all wrongs. These are fairly straightforward, easy to grasp. They seem to have the same meaning for us today as they did in the ancient world when they were first given. But there are some others that are not so easy. How about this one in Ecclesiastes 10:19? A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes life merry, and money's the answer to everything. Really? I mean, is the biblical author telling us that parties and wine and money is the solution to all of life? So obviously this, some of the texts are not as straightforward as others. Some of the texts obviously are going to take some interpretive skill to how to understand. So in this chapter, what we will be doing is trying to give you an overview of the wisdom books and some help then to give you guidelines on how to use the interpretive journey to properly understand and to interpret and to apply the wisdom books. To start off, let's look at the purpose of the wisdom books. And this is important to set the context, the literary context. How do the four fit together, and what is it that the Bible is trying to do with these wisdom books? We'd like to start with a good quote from Derek Kidner. In addressing the wisdom books and how they relate to the rest of the Bible, Kidner says, in other words, in the wisdom books, the tone of voice and even the speakers have changed. The blunt thou shalt or shalt not of the law and the urgent, thus saith the Lord of the prophets, are joined now by the cooler comments of the teacher and the often anguished questions of the learner. where the bulk of the Old Testament calls us simply to obey and to believe this part of it, that is the wisdom books, summons us to think hard as well as humbly, to keep our eyes open, to use our conscience and our common sense, not to shirk the most disturbing questions. So what we see is that while the imperatives of much of the rest of the Bible are obey, trust, believe, when you come to the wisdom books, you find that the imperatives that God gives to us are listen, look, think, reflect, discern. It's not that the great theological story of the Old Testament, that of God's deliverance and God's grace, is not there in the wisdom books. It's that it's pretty much assumed. They assume that in the wisdom books, and then they build upon that. Indeed, Proverbs 1:7 makes this clear when it starts off and says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." The wisdom books then will start with this, starting with the theological foundation. Using the salvation story, the wisdom books then build a practical theology, and there's a stress here on this practical theology for living faithfully and wisely in a very complicated world. And really what the wisdom books are trying to do, the goal, the overall goal of the wisdom books, is beyond just giving us specific applications for specific difficult situations, and certainly those are there. But the overall goal of the wisdom literature is to build a godly character, the formation of a godly character that's wise, that has wisdom and the ability to discern what wise, godly living would be in some very difficult and some very complicated situations. So to get a handle on this, let's back up and kind of look at the big picture. How do the wisdom books fit together, and what's the primary focus of each of the books? And I think it is kind of important to take all of them together. So if you start really with Proverbs, which is the basic, Proverbs gives us the basic approach to life. And Proverbs presents the rational, ordered norms of life, the way things normally are. Proverbs kind of tells us, here's how life normally operates. For instance, if you work hard, you're going to do well in life. And that's a general, basic norm of life. If you're lazy, you're not going to do so well. And so Proverbs presents these norms of life. But notice that these are norms and not universals. There are lots of situations, lots of exceptions that we can think of. For instance, when we lived in Ethiopia back in the 1980s, there was a terrible famine, and for a couple of years it just didn't rain. So there were lots of very godly, righteous Christians in that country who worked hard, but nonetheless had to experience this terrible drought and this terrible famine. So the guidelines and the Proverbs are giving us what's normally true. And Proverbs is also telling us that operating in a world that's logical and rational, there's cause and effects. If you're lazy, you're not going to do well. It's this kind of world that Proverbs deals with. So Proverbs is kind of the starting point, the basics, the rational, ordered norms of life, and that's Proverbs. The other books now are really going to be exceptions to Proverbs, and they're going to balance Proverbs by showing us those times of life, the exceptions in life, when the rational, ordered norms of Proverbs don't really apply. So exception number one, Book of Job, the suffering of the righteous. And the proverbial approach of cause and effect cannot really grasp or understand every aspect of life, especially this, when the righteous suffer. Proverbs says if you're righteous, you obey God and you work hard, you're going to do well and prosper. But the book of Job shows us that that's not necessarily true all the time, that tragedy does strike even the wise and the righteous. And so the book of Job is going to deal with this exception to the rational, ordered norms of life and show us that even in tragedy, what we are to do is to rely on our Creator. So exception one to Proverbs is the suffering of the righteous, the book of Job. Exception two is Ecclesiastes, and it's dealing with the failure of the rational approach to provide ultimate meaning. And Ecclesiastes is it's an intellectual search for meaning. And what Ecclesiastes finds is that if you take a rational, logical approach to life, and look at it carefully, examine it carefully. While it may be good on a day-to-day basis, in a detail-by-detail basis, that the overall approach does not give you the ultimate meaning of life. In fact, it reveals numerous exceptions and anomalies to the ordered rational universe. That's what Ecclesiastes reveals and discovers. And so Ecclesiastes, after this intellectual search, comes to the end and says that meaning in life is really not found through wisdom itself in the rational ordered search, but meaning in life is only found through a relationship with God. Exception number three, then, is the Song of Songs and the irrationality of romantic love. And Song of Songs deals celebrates this wild, irrational, mushy, corny aspects of true love with this young couple who fall in love and are married. And so, boy, you have the rational, ordered norms of Proverbs showing things are kind of distinguished and dignified is how the world works. But Song of Songs is showing you that within this love relationship, this rational ordered approach kind of goes out the window, and they're celebrating this wild, irrational, mushy aspect, and also saying that this is wisdom as well, that this part of life is also included in what godly, wise living is all about. Now, a couple other things to remember that in wisdom, that this is poetry. We talked about poetry in an earlier chapter. Remember, there's parallelism involved. There's figures of speech involved throughout the wisdom literature. And we want to remember how we dealt with some of the poetic aspects in an earlier chapter. The figures of speech, too, are a little bit varied. And what you find is that figures of speech occur more frequently in texts that are more emotional. And so these wisdom books are kind of on a spectrum. Proverbs is very rationally ordered, not so emotional, kind of straightforward. And so it does not contain near as many figures of speech as you find, say, on the other end of the spectrum, the Song of Songs, which is dealing with the very highly emotional issue of romantic love. So if you're in Song of Songs, you're going to have figures of speech in almost every verse. And they will dominate the text, and in interpretation, you'll be dealing constantly with these figures of speech. In Proverbs, you have some, they do show up some, but they're not nearly as dominating as you find over in the Song of Songs. So, be aware of the figures of speech, be aware of the parallelism that we're really taking two lines at a time, as you study the text, and then, be aware of the other aspects that this is poetry, and there will be a lot of figurative language there. So what we'd like to do is in two of the books, let's walk them through the interpretive journey and see how we would deal with each step of the interpretive journey, kind of in general, what passages from these books would look like as we go through the interpretive journey, and see how that helps us to read these very fun, engaging wisdom books and how we can use them to build character in our lives so that we can be wise and lead godly lives. So let's look at Proverbs and walk through the interpretive journey. Step one, grasp the text in their town. One of the things we need to do is make sure that you explore the literary context. And by that, I mean keep it in the context of the rest of the wisdom books and realize going into the book of Proverbs that you need to balance them with those other books and that these are not universals. These are not promises, but these are guidelines and these are the norms and that there are some exceptions. It's helpful to note the structure and the basic units in the book of Proverbs, that the first nine chapters, for instance, is basically a father giving advice to his son. And so the units are longer here, sometimes chapter-long units that you would be dealing with. It's only when you get to chapters 10 to 29 that you have this two-line, verse-at-a-time kind of miscellaneous collection of proverbs, typically of what we think of as a proverb. So if you're in that section, you're dealing with shorter units, just a verse at a time, while in chapters 1 to 9, you're probably dealing with the bigger unit, a chapter at a time. Then, of course, at the end, from 31 to 31, verse 9, you have these sayings of an individual, Agur, and one called King Lemuel. And likewise, these are a little bit longer units that you would be dealing with a longer unit at a time. And then the final closing chapter, of course, is this wonderful one on the wife of noble character. And that one also should be taken as a whole unit. So if you're in chapters 10 to 29, sometimes you're dealing with a verse at a time. They almost stand alone. But in the other sections of Proverbs, you need to deal with the literary units that's there, sometimes a paragraph, sometimes an entire chapter. So note the structure and the basic units of the book when you're beginning here in step one, grasping what it means in their town. Now, as you come to measure the width of the river to cross, a couple of things. Some of the Proverbs, of course, are already pretty universal, and sometimes the river is small, but there are some differences. Number one, Proverbs is written against an agrarian context, assuming that most of the readers, most of the people are farmers, small farmers, and so there's a lot of agrarian-related Proverbs, and so you know, many of us today don't live in that situation. We live in urban settings, so we have to notice that change. Also, Proverbs has many references to kings and assumes that that the readers are living in a monarchy, and so for us today in democracies, it's a different government setting, so we have to be aware that that particular difference between our situation and the situation in Proverbs. As we move to step three, cross the principalizing bridge, well, the typical Proverbs, many of them are already in a very general principle, so a lot of times the statement of the proverb, it's, you know, dealing with things like honesty and friendship and how you speak and don't slander people and always tell the truth, work hard, you know, respect other people. These kinds of proverbs are usually already stated in a general principle. So they come across without a whole lot of change. We create their principle, and really they come across looking very much the same because they're already stated in a principle form. But keep in mind that these are not promises. These are not universal promises. God is not saying, if you work hard, I will indeed bless you with prosperity. That's a health and wealth gospel that the New Testament speaks against. So they're not promises. They're guidelines. They're principles that say this is the normative way of life. This is the advice for how you should live life. So keep that in mind as you formulate these principles and come across on step three. Step four is we consult the biblical map. Many of the themes in Proverbs, most of the themes in Proverbs are reaffirmed in the New Testament, and they're reinforced there. So you move through the New Testament, a lot of times the principle stays very much the same. But this theme of wealth as a blessing from God does undergo an alteration and does change as you move from the Old Testament to the New Testament. In the Old Testament, as the people go into the Promised Land, God tells them that if they're obedient to Him and they follow Him, stay faithful to Him, that He will bless them. And so there is this blessing promise that if people are faithful, then they will prosper, and it's a certain material blessing that's promised. When you get to the New Testament, that promise is just not there. The promise of wealth blessing is kind of dropped, and there is this ultimately an eschatological blessing that in the kingdom to come, that will be the time when the followers of Jesus Christ will be blessed. In the meantime, following Jesus Christ may mean foregoing wealth and giving up all, picking up your cross and following Him. So we have to be careful if we're carrying this theme of wealth across the bridge when we come to the New Testament to realize the New Testament does qualify that theme. So step five, grasp the text in their town. And here, again, you want to catch the big picture that the text is telling us not just things to do, specific things to do, which is important, but it's telling us how to be, what to be, how we should be thinking, looking, approaching life. What are some of the general characteristics that we should embrace in our character as we live? So when we grasp the text here in our town, then we want to be sure that we're concerned with our character development. So that's Proverbs, and it's a fairly straightforward, little easy book to read. Let's look at another one now. Let's walk through the book of Job and walk it through the interpretive journey as well. When we come to Job now, remember that Job's basically a story, and it's a complete story, unlike Proverbs, where you can pull out individual verses in the middle and make perfect sense of them, study them, and apply them. In Job, you just cannot do this. You have to situate your smaller passage into the larger context of the whole story, and you have to take the whole story as a whole. And again, here's kind of how the story unfolds in chapters 1 and 2 to 2:10. You know, Job is afflicted. Here's how the story starts. He loses everything. His life crashes. He has these terrible tragedies happen in his life. So that's the opening part of the story. Then in 2:11 to 37:24, a big bulk of the middle of the book, then Job and his friends search unsuccessfully for a rational answer. They are really using the book of Proverbs, the theology, the kind of thinking in Proverbs, that things are rational, ordered, logical. And so Job's friends think if terrible tragedies have happened to Job, then he must have done something wrong. That's their conclusion. Job knows he hasn't done something big wrong, and so he's puzzled and baffled, and what he does is he questions God's justice in this. So they have this long search where they are searching unsuccessfully for some kind of rational answer to what's happening. The final answers actually come in Job 38:1 to 42:6, and this is the most important part of the book, because here is where God comes and answers Job's accusations. And God will tell Job, look, you need to trust me that I'm sovereign and that I know how to run the universe. And so we really get the ultimate answer to the book and how to approach the tragedy of suffering in this section from 38:1 to 42:6. And then at the end, God restores Job completely and has a rebuke to his friends, kind of exonerating Job and returning Job to the situation that he was at the beginning of the book. So let's walk it through then, the interpretive journey. Step one is we grasp the text in their town. Again, you have to identify the literary context. Where are you in the book? Be careful of pulling text out of the middle of the book and trying to interpret them independently of the entire story. And remember that the central lessons don't come until you get to 38:1, 42:17, where God speaks and God gives the explanation. He gives the answer. He's the one that shows that their rational search for an answer is futile. And at that point, they have to trust in the sovereignty of God and trust in the character of God. So that lesson doesn't come until 38 to 42. So, and keep in mind, too, as we grasp the text, the near town in the first part, that the Job's friends are negative. By and large, they're negative characters. They kind of miss the boat. They misapply the theology of Proverbs to Job's situation. So they're not models for us to be followed. They're kind of negative characters. So as we move to step two, to measure the width of the river to cross, the river's not that wide on some points. I mean, suffering and tragedy is very universal. So there's a sense in which human tragedy and human suffering is very similar in the ancient world as it is now. What we have to be aware of in measuring the width of the river is that we cannot assume that since Job's tragedy was connected to satanic involvement, that all tragedy and all bad things that happen in our life are likewise connected to satanic involvement. Occasionally, bad things happen in my life just from my own dumb mistakes. And so sometimes what's needed is just a recognition of that and repentance. But unexplained tragedy and undeserved tragedy and just the normal chaos that happens in life and terrible things that seem to happen, inexplicable tragedies that happen in life, do seem to be somewhat universal. So in that sense, the river's very narrow when we're just dealing with tragedies. As you cross the principalizing bridge, okay, here again, since tragedy is so common, that usually the principle will be fairly straightforward. And when you get into that section, when God speaks from 38 to 42, the principles that he shares with Job in there about trusting in his control of history and trusting that God is just and trusting that God's character is what you should rely on, these are fairly universal principles, easily formulated, and we come across with very similar principles for today as we had in step one and the way Job would have understood it. So step four, we consult the biblical map. As we've mentioned in Proverbs, the New Testament doesn't repeat this picture that peace and prosperity comes as a result of righteous living. And the New Testament suggests, really, that righteous people glorify God by enduring their unjust suffering. So the New Testament takes the theology of Job to trust in the sovereignty of God and to trust in God's control and to trust that God is indeed just. And it adds another component that says sometimes righteous people in following Jesus Christ will have to endure suffering, and they can indeed even glorify God by the way that they endure this suffering. And then this brings us to step five, to grasp the text in our town. And remember that our focus in grief then should not be on the why, but it should be on God and His character. We should be trusting in God, that He knows what He's doing, that there is justice in the universe, and we should rely on God when we don't understand what's happening in life. And that application is good, easy for us, important for us to grasp in tragedy. And another application that comes out of this is that Job's friends really kind of missed the boat as far as comforting him. And so we should realize that when our friends are suffering, that we should hurt and suffer with them. We should not expect to come up with some kind of logical explanation always for what's happened. But again, we should trust in God, but we should be with them, hurt and suffer with them. And these are the applications when we come into step five. So, the wisdom book's a summary. You know, Proverbs presents the norms, the rational ordered norms of life. And then the others, Job, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, present the exceptions, these exceptions. And we take these as a whole. Taken as a whole, they cover all of life. And these wisdom books then are fascinating and interesting and challenging. And they give us all kinds of helpful guidelines for building wise and godly character in our lives so that we can lead a day-to-day wise, godly life and live for the Lord with wisdom in today's very complicated world that we face each day.
Either there or the floor is off. Look at Hebrews chapter 12. I'll start with verse 1 just to get the flow of things. Hebrews 12:1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also, who are the great cloud of witnesses? Chapter 11, right? Chapter 11. Notice the therefore, so he's referring back to what he already did. Let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. So here the author to the Hebrews takes this passage from Proverbs and takes it directly over to the people that he's writing to and says, God is addressing you. And I think that's the way we should approach the book of Proverbs as well. It's so straightforward. Are those promises?
No.
No. What did, how do they explain it on the video? This is normally the way things work, but not always. Not always. Job is an exception to those principles. Okay? And the Proverbs don't actually start until which chapter? 10. You were thinking of Job.
Okay.
Yeah, Proverbs 10. The first 9 chapters are all a plea on the father's part to get wisdom. Okay. Whatever it costs you, get wisdom, he says. Okay. All right, I'm going to ask you some questions. Incidentally, he made reference to Derek Kidner. Derek Kidner, Dr. Bruce K. Waltke, and Alan Ross, he's also a doctor.
Should we be writing these down?
Only if you want to. These guys are my favorite Old Testament authors. Okay. Kidner wrote in the Tyndale commentary series, he has commentaries on Genesis, Psalms, and Proverbs. Bruce Walt, he has stuff on the Psalms. I think there's some on maybe some of the minor prophets. But his big works is in Proverbs. He has a 2-volume commentary on Proverbs. And then Ross, he's the one that he wrote the one you're reading in Genesis, but he also has a more detailed on Genesis, Leviticus, and a 3-volume commentary on Psalms. Okay, so now here's some questions. True or false? You're going to have a lot of questions today because, as I mentioned, we're also going to review for the exam.
That also makes me think about this roll sheet. Did everybody, some of you came in late. So did everybody get the roll sheet? Anybody not get the roll sheet? Because if you missed the roll sheet, you always have to make sure you tell me, because otherwise I have no idea you were here, right?
Is that for super noisy?
Pardon?
Even if we're super noisy and annoying?
Well, I might remember that. Okay. Okay, true or false? The wisdom books flow out of the theology of the Old Testament. True. A majority of wisdom literature is poetry. True. According to Ecclesiastes, wisdom is the source of ultimate meaning in life.
False.
Song of Songs depicts human love as logical and rational.
False.
Yeah, I think this is the original book on Twitter pated. Okay. How many of you know where the expression Twitter pated comes from?
It doesn't come from the Twitter app.
Where does it get? Does it come from the Bible?
I literally just watched the video clip last night.
Where does it come from?
Is it from Bambi?
Bambi. Yeah,
that's right.
How many of you have never seen Bambi? There's a few, just a few of you. Okay. Bambi. Okay. So Bambi. This is another true or false. The basic historical context of Proverbs is that of an agrarian society.
Sure.
I'm confused about that because I've always been told it was Solomon writing to his son Rehoboam.
No, it's not. It's not addressed to one son. It's addressed to his sons. So some people think it's even broader than his literal sons and other young men in the kingdom.
If it's from a king to his offspring, the royalty aren't doing the farm work. So I'm confused.
Well, they still live in an agrarian culture, though. Their primary thing is agrarian, right? The king has flocks and all that stuff. Everybody has flocks. Okay. But as they brought up in the video, there's also kings in the background. Okay. So this is the fill in the blank, which of course you don't have on your the final exam. Okay, what presents wisdom that is based upon the rational, ordered norms of life?
Proverbs.
In which wisdom book does tragedy strike a righteous man?
Job.
A blank is usually composed of two short lines of poetry that express one general truth of wisdom.
Proverb.
What kind of did any of you grow up with a proverb you've never forgotten?
Don't spit in the wind.
Don't spit in the wind. Okay. Okay.
I thought we were like actual proverbs.
No, I'm talking. Well, that's okay too.
I mean, the Proverbs 3, 5, and 6.
Okay.
My dad always has interesting things, like if I had spare horses, would ride half the time.
If you don't have something nice to say, don't say.
That's from Bambi too, isn't it? Here's the one I grew up with. Here's the one I grew up with. If you can't hear, you gotta feel. If you can't hear, you gotta feel. What do you think that means?
Nothing.
That means if you don't obey, you're gonna get...
If you can't hear, you're gonna feel like.
If you can't hear, if you can't hear, you gotta feel. Okay. What key term used in Ecclesiastes is often translated meaningless? Anybody remember the word? Starts with an H. H E B E. Hebel, right. Hebel or Hebel. Throughout much of church history, Song of Songs was believed to be what type of literature?
Allegory.
Allegory. Well, allegory about what? Christ in the church, right? So those are the two basic approaches. Some see it as allegory. I don't think it's allegory, but, and then the other one, it's actually, love song, basically. Okay, multiple choice. Which of the following is an interpretive stressed by the wisdom books? Believe, keep, think, obey.
Okay.
No?
Think.
That reminded me of another movie, but I wouldn't recommend the movie to you. Years ago when I watched it, it didn't seem that bad, but if you watch it now, there's some pretty bad questionable stuff in there. I'm talking about Back to the Future. Okay. Think. Remember how he says, what's that guy's name?
Marty.
Think, Marty. Think. Okay. What's the primary goal of wisdom literature?
To make us wise.
These are your choices. Okay, who said that? Right, godly character. Character. The primary thing is character.
What about godly
character? That's what it's meant to develop in us, godly character. For example, look at Proverbs 4. Actually, it's 3 that I want. 3:1-4. 3:1-4. My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you. Do not let kindness and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. So you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and man. You'll have a good reputation in the eyes of God and man, is what he's saying. So that's kind of the emphasis throughout those first 9 chapters. Wisdom will keep you from the evil man and the evil woman. Have I walked you through some of Proverbs 9 before?
No.
Man, this class is flying by. Okay. So we'll do that maybe later. We don't have time to do it now. So the primary goal of wisdom literature is character. Primary character of which wisdom book is called the teacher. Ecclesiastes. Song of Songs is a celebration of what basic human relationship?
Love, marriage.
Marriage. What's the standard structural feature of wisdom literature?
Poetry.
Parallelism. All right, now you can record if you want, if you haven't been already. This is the exam. Okay, there are 20 true or false. I think I dropped one of those. There are 15,
Will we get a study guide for this?
This is your study guide. Right. Okay, I gotta run and get something. I don't have the correct part there where I changed it.
How are you doing, Ellie? I'm doing pretty great. How are you? Normally, I'm just tired by class 5, so I'm kind of worried about myself right now.
Well, darn great. Go get yourself some coffee.
Okay, now I got the right one. I had the old one, not the one I changed. Okay, so there are 20 true or false worth 3 points. There are 15 matching worth 1 point. And then there are 15 multiple choice. And those are worth 2 points. Okay, true or false. The gospel writers arranged Jesus' actions thematically.
False.
True. According to the way, however they're presenting Christ, that's the way they order their material, right? The book of Acts continues the story told in the Gospel of Luke.
True.
The leading figure throughout Acts is the Holy Spirit.
True.
When reading Revelation, I always read it literally.
False.
According to the traditional approach for interpreting Old Testament law, moral laws are applicable to contemporary Christians.
True,
but is that right? No, the statement's true, but is it right to do that?
No.
No. Okay.
So, for the test, are you wanting to say that's true or false?
It's true.
Okay.
That is the normal way, or the traditional approach. Okay. All scripture is applicable to a New Testament believer. True. The Psalms, applicable is the key word there, right? Applicable. The Psalms teach us that honesty is not the best policy when it comes to talking to God.
False.
Why to God? Okay.
That works so well for Adam and Sarah.
Right. The designation major prophets is given to the prophetic books, which should be considered more important.
False.
A majority of wisdom literature is poetry.
True.
There is a correlation between a person's knowledge of the Bible and their perception of self and others.
True.
Authorial intention assumes that the author is communicating to the reader through the text.
True.
Song of Songs depicts human love as logical and rational.
False.
The majority of prophetic literature deals with future events.
False.
Poetry appeals to reason.
False.
Old Testament poetry is a good source for developing doctrine and propositional truth.
False.
The promises of the Mosaic Covenant are unconditional.
False.
Meaning in narrative literature is found in the actions of characters. True. That's like in dialogue between them and things like that. Students of Revelation can disregard historical context and still understand its literary meaning.
False.
The speeches in Acts are not verbatim accounts, therefore they should not be trusted.
False.
The Gospels of Matthew and Luke record the details surrounding the birth of Christ.
True.
Okay, these are the matching. And it's going to be kind of... You want me to tell you what your choices are first? Pardon?
Just the right answer.
Good response. Okay. So these are your choices. So there's a list of them here. Context, Proverbs, Caesar, Acts, Parallelism, Ceremonial, Acts 2:28, Narrative, Domitian, Job, Revelation, John, Parable, Author, Acts 1:8, Psalms, Narrator, Parable, Coveting, Lusting, Idolatry. Remember you have more there than the exact things. Okay, a story with two levels of meaning where certain details in the story represent something else. What'd you say? Somebody said the right answer, but no. Parable. This book is best described as theological history.
Acts.
The Roman emperor from 81 AD to 96 AD, he wanted his subjects to address him as our Lord and God. Domitian. A literary form characterized by sequential time action and involving plot, setting, and characters.
Narrative.
According to the traditional approach to the Mosaic law, this kind of law, deals with sacrifices, priests, and festivals.
Ceremonial.
The dominant structure characteristic of Old Testament poetry.
Parallelism.
Presents wisdom that is based upon the rational, ordered norms of life.
Proverbs.
This is always crucial regardless of which type of literature is being studied.
Context.
The wisdom book in which tragedy strikes a righteous man.
Job.
The three primary charges the prophets brought against Israel and Judah were social injustice, religious ritual, and
idolatry.
Idolatry. what gives us inspired models of how to talk and sing to God? Songs. In narrative literature, this person conveys the meaning of the story to the readers.
Narrator.
The main message of this book is God wins.
Revelation.
Acts chapter and verse holds the key to understanding as the entire book of Acts unfolds.
1:8.
When reading an individual story, you should pay attention to any interpretive instructions that the might put in the text. Who?
Author.
Okay, that's all of that. Now we got that multiple choice. Which of the following is not considered a synoptic gospel?
John.
Matt? Okay, John. What's the name of the festival when the Holy Spirit descended upon, indwelt, and empowered the disciples of Jesus?
Pentecost.
What are the two parts of biblical prophecy? You want the choices?
Near view, far view.
No, prediction, well that's true, but in some cases anyway. Prediction and parable, proclamation and parallelism, prophecy and proclamation, parable and parallelism. Right, prophecy and proclamation. You are like whitewashed tombs is an example of which special literary form?
Simile.
What's the key word?
Like.
Which interpretive strategy for Acts views Acts as inspiring and valuable, but not necessarily binding? Normative, descriptive, social, rhetorical, both and? Descriptive. Okay. The skills required to read which New Testament genre are most applicable to the Old Testament narrative?
Gospel.
Letter? Okay, gospel. Thank you. Which of the following covenants is the context for the Old Testament law? Abrahamic, Noahic, Mosaic, or Davidic?
Mosaic.
Skills required to read which New Testament genre are most applicable to the Old Testament narrative?
Old Testament.
Gospel. Because they're also narrative.
Oh.
What category of parallelism best describes the following lines? The one enthroned in heaven laughs, the Lord scoffs at them. Is this synonymous, developmental, contrastive, or illustrative?
Synonymous.
Which of the following prophets is not considered a minor prophet? Daniel, Hosea, Joel, or Amos?
Daniel.
What's the primary goal of wisdom literature?
Character.
Which of the following is an imperative stressed by the wisdom books? We talked about this a little bit ago. Believe, keep, think, or obey?
Think.
If a biblical poet describes God as having hands, arms, and feet, then the poet is using what figurative element?
Anthropomorphism.
Which word best describes Jesus' relationship to the law with respect to contemporary Christians? Abolish, fulfill, keep, or obey?
Fulfill.
Which of the following biblical books does not contain Old Testament law? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, or Deuteronomy?
Genesis.
So that's the entire exam, which we'll take on Monday morning. Okay, you can come and get your phones, and then we'll take a 5-minute break.